Ilearn scores are bad. An Indiana family sues e-cigarette maker Juul. Plus, Vice President Pence's stay in Ireland and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 6th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the scores from Indiana's new standardized test, iLearn, were publicly unveiled, and less than half of Hoosier students made the grade. According to state data, less than half of all students reached proficiency in English language arts and math. A year ago, about 51% of students passed both portions on the ISTEP test. This year, on the new exam, only 37% of students passed both. State Department of Education officials say the new test was designed to be more rigorous and better evaluate students' college and career readiness. State leaders, including lawmakers, the governor, and State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick, have all called for a pause in accountability for schools and teachers, shielding them from the poor results. But some State Board of Education members argue the results shouldn't be totally disregarded. The scores are the scores, as Board Member Tony Walker put it.
I think there's something here that reflects a problem that's statewide and needs to be addressed. So while we're holding harmless, hopefully everyone's working on the problem.
Just how troubling are the poor iLearn scores? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Jennifer Hollowell, we discussed last week the necessity of the hold harmless. Aside from that, how troubling are these scores?
Well, very troubling. I mean, very troubling for a lot of reasons, and troubling enough that the governor and others are calling on the General Assembly to enact the hold harmless so that schools and teachers aren't impacted by these scores and it doesn't impact their, you know, salaries or their school grades. And, you know, we've gone through twists and turns on statewide testing, right? I mean, we do have to have a standardized test in order to comply with federal requirements. iLearn is now the new one. I think it's here to stay, right? We've gone through this path, and obviously the changes have been difficult. And so now as we transition, this is our starting point, and hopefully we see improvements and learn something from it.
The idea here is that iLearn is supposed to be the best test we've ever had in terms of as accurate as possible, understanding how ready our kids are for college or their careers. If it is as good as we hope it is, what is that telling us about where our kids are?
This test is nonsense, okay? The whole process is nonsense. When we started this in 2010 and adopted Common Core, the pass rate was 70%, okay? And over the ensuing 4 years until the legislature said, well, if President Obama likes Common Core, we can't take that test. We have to do our own because our children are special and they can't compete with students from other states. So we had gone from 70% passage to 75% passage. Modest but incremental progress. Then they put in the ISTEP Plus, and those rates plummet to, 53.5%, okay? So they're going to fix that. They're going to hold harmless. They're not going to use it. They're going to go back in. They're going to do it again. And the governor and the legislature goes in again and spends tens of millions of dollars developing their own test to some for-profit agency out there that markets these things instead of taking the federal one off the shelf, and now we're down to an overall pass rate of 37%. It's a disgrace how much money has been wasted.
Is that a
on
problem
this.
Of the testing, or is that saying
you think the
our kids
students
aren't?
Are, oh wait, did they all of a sudden get dumb? Did the teachers all of a sudden not learn how to teach? No, I don't think so. I think it's the problem with the test. And on top of that, they use it in the legislature as an indicator that public schools are failing. And so that justifies more money to vouchers and more money to charter schools and more money to virtual schools, taking it all from the 93% of the kids that are in public schools and not paying teachers adequately. All of that is of a piece. And the legislature and the governor need to get out of this system because they obviously don't know what they're doing.
Ann brought up the fact that we just had a new test before this new test a few years ago, and there was a hold harmless process through that when the scores dropped. And
well, we had new state standards then.
Right, and somebody at the state board pointed out that we haven't really recovered from that dip at this point.
Yeah, I think the most interesting part is, look, no one is arguing that this test is wrong or unreliable. It is what it is, and our students can't pass it. But yet I didn't really hear any urgency on that issue. It was all about how we rate the schools and stuff like that. But, I mean, you're right. At some point we had 75% going. But along the way, those kids weren't getting into colleges, and their parents were saying, what the heck? I got straight A student who has passed all the I-STEP, but they can't get into Purdue or IU because their ACT scores or the SAT scores weren't high enough. So they rebuilt this test to make it harder on the front end so that hopefully there's less, you know, shock at the end. But guess what? That's painful, and we're seeing it right now.
State Board Member Tony Walker talked exactly about that issue. We quoted him in the piece, which was, and the larger scope of his comments were, I agree with the hold harmless. We shouldn't be penalizing teachers and schools because of these growing pains that we're going through, but let's not have that be the focus.
That's right. And if, in fact, this test says stylistic questioning, or how the questions are worded and how it's presented, all of that notwithstanding, if two-thirds of Hoosiers aren't college-ready, to Nikki's point, that's a problem. And
starting in third grade?
I don't know at what point you're supposed to deem somebody eligible. But I think the flip side of this is a lot of the national experts, people at RAND Corporation and the other groups that study this for a living, say this is really not out of sync with what has happened in other states when they have unveiled new tests. It takes time to adjust. So let's hope.
Does that mean it takes time to teach to the test?
Well, doesn't even work that way, because when they did the I-STEP Plus for the four intervening years, the test scores went down only fractionally, but down every single year that they were, quote, teaching to the test.
One thing I'm curious about, so 17,000 schools in Indiana, and virtually all of them were worse. Whether they passed or failed is another issue, but they got worse, except for 45 schools out of 17,000 got better. Now, I haven't looked to see where these are, but I would be curious if there's any common theme in terms of the teaching. I guess it has maybe more to do with, you know, the financial wherewithal of the districts and so forth, but if there is something in there that is a takeaway, it might be useful that others can learn. And in the meantime, I would take these students and give them all honorary degrees just to go straight to their doctorate.
The one variation here, which disproportionately affects poorer students, is that this is the first computer-only test. Okay. Now, for example, in Pike Township, which is, I think, now 8% Caucasian in Pike Township, the students there in one of the schools have been given Chromebooks. They share, but they can't take them home. So they're getting some experience. They don't have home computers, and they come in and they're expected to take this test on a computer. I mean, that's an immediate disadvantage for a large percentage of inner city students, period.
Well, an Indiana family has sued Juul, one of the largest e-cigarette manufacturers, arguing the company didn't properly advertise how addictive its products are. The McCullough family of Carmel filed the lawsuit and alleges Juul didn't include nicotine warnings on its devices, pods, and packaging. The McCullough's 17-year-old son uses e-cigarettes, and the lawsuit says, quote, altered his brain physically and chemically and put him at risk for a lifetime of lifelong health problems. Governments across the country are taking a closer look at e-cigarettes, particularly as vaping is blamed for a mysterious respiratory illness that has sickened about 200 people in the U.S. and claimed at least one life. Michigan, for instance, just became the first state to ban flavored e-cigarettes. Last session, Indiana failed to impose cigarette taxes on e-cigarettes or raise the minimum age to purchase such products from 18 to 21. And Delaney, we learned today the State Department of Health announced that they are reporting the first death that they say is from vaping in Indiana, the third nationwide. Does Indiana need to get more involved here from a government perspective?
They had the opportunity last session to pass taxes on this. Okay, we know nicotine's addictive. And we know we need to be taxing these to discourage the use of it. And we could have, the same thing with cigarettes. We could have upped the cigarette tax. You know, the Republicans are so afraid of a tax, no matter what it does, that they don't even want to recognize when they have a problem here. Both of these things should be taxed out of existence, in my opinion. And vaping is one of them that's ripe for that. And all the nonsense about whether it's at the where the chemicals originate or the retail sales or whatever is an excuse not to do it.
So that was part of the argument, was it is complicated to figure out how to tax it. But there, I think, is a bigger debate over, philosophically, there are some people who believe, and the companies market them that way, is this is an alternative to smoking, that this is something you could do that isn't as harmful as traditional cigarettes. Is that narrative falling apart a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it is. All over the country we're seeing these stories. What we don't know is what kind of products people are using that are having these awful outcomes and deaths in some cases. You know, what kind of vaping product is. They're all different kinds. You know, a couple of years ago, the legislature passed a really strict law on vaping and then revisited it and repealed a lot of it. And some of the argument then was, you know, it's the Wild Wild West that you've got people mixing stuff in sinks and bathtubs and selling it in shops, and that's problematic, and we should follow, you know, a chain of custody and do different things like that. The bottom line is, this is a horrible crisis, and especially for young people, because to your question, is it healthier or safer? If you're a longtime smoker and you go to some sort of vaping device, it may be. We don't know for sure yet, but it may be healthier, and I'm inclined to think maybe it is. But if you're 12 and up, or, you know, I mean, these kids are getting hooked right away, and it is really hard to stop vaping, smoking, any of that. And so they're addicted for potentially life, and they're also wasting lots of money and potentially harming themselves. So we have to regulate it. The feds need to crack down. Michigan just passed a law banning flavored. And something has to be done.
Jennifer, I mean, if you're under 18, it's not currently legal in Indiana for you to buy these products, so it's not as if that needs to change. But she just brought up you're getting hooked and it's expensive. Do we need to make it more expensive? Is that going to be maybe the biggest trick to trying to get kids to stop?
Pocketbook, if you hit somebody in the wallet or the purse, that is, I think, arguably the most effective way long-term to eradicate the problem, unless there is a black market where, and then, again, this is a whole other regulatory issue, if you're dealing with off-brand substances, which, as you suggest, Jennifer, you're cooking up in bathtubs or in, you know, amateur hour. Would, in fact, regulation of legitimate regulated products force more people who are addicted into those other alternatives? I guess much as we've seen, for instance, with, you know, prescription opioids, people turning to the cheaper alternative, in many cases, of heroin. It's interesting to watch governments try to struggle with this because of the geography questions, where things are produced, where they're sold, you know, retail, wholesale. But I do, you mentioned at the end of your remarks there, and I think it's worth revisiting what Michigan did this week, and that is going after the flavors. So whether it's something like gummy bears or maybe something more, quote unquote, mainstream, such as mint or menthol, no flavoring. Now, they still have to set up their regulatory apparatus over the next month or two to figure out how to enforce this. But it seems that when the concern is keeping this from being attractive to younger users especially, taking the flavor away might be a start. And so I would guess that other states might follow suit. Other municipalities have taken. San Francisco, I think, had done something similar. But Michigan was the first state, and we'll see if it's not the last.
Do you think there's more momentum now because of, I mean, this has been happening all summer long, and obviously the first death in Indiana. Does that give it enough momentum to head into session with more backing?
I think so. The fact is they were pretty close to the tax. I mean, it died on the last day. So I think this will definitely push them that way. And they'll be looking at other things like, you know, making it part of the smoking ban or, you know, raising the age. I think those will all be discussions. I will say this on the flavor thing. When I was chatting with my daughter, who does vape against my better judgment, when I mentioned a vaping tax and the flavors, she said both those things would cause her to quit because she can't afford it and she doesn't like the taste of it without the flavor.
So we need to do
both.
But
I got to tell you, there's a lot of teenagers who are spending their parents' money on this and the tax is not going to impact them.
No.
Well, then the parents need to step up.
Yeah, that's some of
that's
the government.
But they don't know. the parents don't know. And
how can they not know?
Because you have no idea if somebody is juuling. It is a little thing. Yeah.
There's no idea. How do they know they're not spending? How do you pay the parents not know they're spending?
Because if you have a weekly allowance and you
trust me, 20 bucks doesn't buy you.
You pretend like you're buying lunch at school and you're spending 50 bucks on that. Parents aren't going to know that. And you can
for lunches, you put it on the account.
It goes unnoticed in smoking bans because it isn't something, unless you're doing the big vape things that make the big clouds, you can do these other products. And
it's something schools are struggling with, too, is trying to, taking the stall doors off in bathrooms just to stop kids from vaping in the restroom.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should e-cigarettes be included in Indiana's statewide smoking ban? A yes or B no? Last week's question, is Indiana too reliant on standardized test scores in driving teacher evaluations and school letter grades? 84% of you say yes, 16% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Vice President Mike Pence drew criticism this week when he stayed at a Trump resort on his diplomatic trip to Ireland, hours away from his meetings with Irish leaders. Pence stayed at the Trump resort in Doonbeg, hours away from Irish capital Dublin. That meant costly travel every day to attend scheduled meetings with Irish leaders, all at taxpayer expense. Pence Chief of Staff Mark Short first said Pence's stay at the Trump resort was at the president's suggestion. The White House denied that, which led to Short changing his tune. Pence then said only the Trump resort could accommodate the unique footprint of the vice president's entourage, and then the story changed again, with the VP saying his stay in Doonbeg was because of family roots there. John Schwanes, there have been lingering questions basically for the entirety of the Trump presidency about the president and his business enterprises and the way they're entangled. Does this heighten them in any significant way?
You would have thought so, but alas, I'm not sure. Last week I talked about the Teflon-coated bubble of impunity, and I may have to dredge that up again this week. So you would think in a normal political climate, that is, virtually any other president that came before this one, this would have been a big deal. And it's a big deal, I guess, to the extent that now two separate House committees have announced here at the end of the week that they will be requested documentation, and they are going to look into this. But you look at the Emoluments Clause lawsuits that dealt with Trump Hotel in D.C. and who was
really
staying there, didn't really get much traction. But, I mean, I don't remember if – I don't know what Ronald Reagan's Hollywood contracts were, but this is akin to saying that, you know, only military bases can show old Ronald Reagan movies so he gets the royalties if, in fact, he had that kind of deal negotiated. I mean, you're making money off these things. And what happened to the blind trust days – that was facetious. I don't think that Ronald Reagan had royalties or did he force anybody to show his movies. But, I mean, the other cliche is the peanut farm that Jimmy Carter had being put in a blind trust. I mean, that used to be sort of the standard operating procedure.
It feels like the first 2 years of the Trump administration, this would have been a story and then it would have gone away. But does the fact that, as you just pointed out, there are now House committees who can and want to investigate this elevate it in any way?
Probably not. I think the more interesting part of this story is once again showing the friction between the Trump and the Pence camps. You know, the fact that the story changed multiple times, that Trump was very upset, that he was kind of thrown under the bus, I think is the more interesting part of as we continue to see little bits coming out about how they butt heads.
Yeah, the story changed three times. Is it really just the first one that sounds?
Oh, it's clearly the first one. And Mike Pence's brother has spent $45,000 of his campaign money staying in Trump hotels since he's been elected, too. So, I mean, the Emoluments Clause is interesting, but this is taxpayer money, okay? This is taxpayer money we're spending to have him hours away from where he's supposed to be so that the Trump administration's corporate interests can profit from it. It is shocking. It's as shocking as when he suggested holding the next G7 meeting at Mar-a-Lago, or the fact that he goes away every weekend. Remember the complaints we used to have as to whether or not Barack Obama was taking too many vacations? When was the last time this guy worked on a Saturday? It just doesn't happen.
I do want to ask about one point that Ann made, which was the idea, this is taxpayer money, that there was more money spent on this trip than there needed to be, quote unquote, if he had just stayed where all of his meetings were. Does that matter to the average taxpayer?
First of all of the foreign travel, any time the president or vice president travels somewhere, there's cost to that, cost that, you know, taxpayers are surprised by, but it's part of it. It's the way it's always been because of the footprint that they have, the entourage that they have, the security that they need.
Well, and that was the second explanation.
It also is, you know, challenging to find places that can accommodate all of those things. There aren't a lot of hotels or accommodations that can deal with all of that. Clearly, the Trump Hotel can. And so I don't really think that this is a big deal.
So there's no other place in Dublin where they could have stayed?
There may be, but I'm just saying, so maybe there are two or three options. This is just a little bit different and also close to the family or home. Makes sense to me.
That's the third explanation they gave as to why they were there.
I think they're all true, right?
I think the first one is true. He was told to stay there.
There's no reason why he couldn't stay there.
All right. Well, the Hoosier Lottery generated a record amount of revenue for the state over the last year, and lottery officials aren't done trying to boost those numbers even further in the future. The state will get $312 million from the Hoosier Lottery based on revenue from the fiscal year that ended in June. That's the most ever, $6 million better than last year. The bulk of that money goes into the Build Indiana Fund, which primarily helps reduce the amount Hoosiers have to pay for their vehicle registration at the BMV. The rest of the lottery money goes to teacher and police and firefighter pension funds. The private company, IGT Indiana, that runs the lottery, exceeded the revenue target it needed to hit, meaning it will get an $11 million bonus this year. IGT is also exploring online lottery options. A lottery official says a recommendation should be ready next year.
Nikki Kelly, all of this can be done without legislative approval. Do you think lawmakers will be comfortable with that if that's what ends up happening?
Look, there's always some that aren't going to be comfortable with it. But honestly, I would love to hear the rationale against it because we are so far down this rabbit hole. I mean, you know, we've approved sports betting where you're on your phone. We've got 14 casinos. We can play pool tabs in the bar. So why the lottery wouldn't be able to sell tickets online would be a really interesting discussion to hear.
Yeah, is it the sports betting online that really put it over the top, that there aren't going to be that many objections if this happens?
Well, there are those who've said, of course, we'll stand for no expansion of gaming. And over the past, 20-plus years, quarter century, somehow people have been able to make the mental construct that we're still where we were. It's just not an expansion,
different
but enhancements,
yeah.
Different versions. So, you know, be that as it may, it's hard to argue that this, you know, if you're going to have all these things, you know, the argument not to maximize the benefit of the gaming infrastructure that's in place for the benefit of the citizens of the state, it's kind of hard to argue against that. The other thing I guess I would note is perhaps those, I think we've all talked about how gaming revenue of different types. I'm talking now about the casino money and online betting. You know, let's not get too used to it because with more competition,
yeah,
the market, now there's a, you know,
that doesn't
there's
seem
saturation.
To apply to the lottery, though.
Strangely enough, not. Because I think the storyline, the conventional wisdom was that as more states offered these types of things, the early adopters, we're not going to have the advantage anymore. But somehow, some way, there's something that they're doing right.
Let me ask a fundamental question. Should the lottery be available to play online?
Absolutely. Sure. I don't see why not. And it makes all the sense in the world. It's the next phase of this. Yeah.
You think that's okay?
I think that's okay. I think it's interesting that they're very comfortable when the state operates gaming, which is really more of a tax on the poor than anything else. That's okay. But, you know, taxing cigarettes more or vaping or things
I'll
like that.
I'll play more if it's online. I can promise you that.
Will you?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, and this gets back to what...
I don't go into gas stations very often.
This gets back to what Ben Smoltz, Representative Ben Smoltz, said during session when we were talking about the sports gaming being online. If you can bet on a sporting event from the comfort of your living room on your phone, what argument is there that you can't play poker from the comfort of your living room on your phone or, to extend it to this, play the lottery on your phone from the comfort of your living room? Well, finally, this weekend is the 26th running of the Brickyard 400, the NASCAR race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Panelists, who do you have winning? I will start with you, Ann Delaney.
The car that's over the finish line first.
Wow. I really like that. Can you put that bet at the sports book?
I think I probably can.
Isn't not quite allowed that
awesome.
One?
Ryan Newman.
Ooh, Ryan Newman. I like that one.
Well, I checked, and the odds makers say Kyle Busch.
Oh, that was going to be my pick. Apparently, I'm with the odds makers.
I was going to say, on Jeopardy, you only have to give last names, so I'll say Bush, because then I figure I double my chances.
Yeah,
Bush.
Here's the second part of the question. Will any of you be availing yourselves of the new opportunity at Indiana Sports Bulls?
No.
Not going for that?
No. Maybe soon on some football. We'll see.
I don't like to bet on football because I would have bet on the Bears last night, for instance, and
that
would
not. Lost.
Yeah, right. That would have gone very, very poorly for me.
IU over Eastern Illinois. You heard it here first.
There you go.
You better hope IU beats Eastern Illinois. All right. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.